Let's resume. I think we have just enough time to finish out this handout and be done with it. So we were talking about while loops. And the notion was that we had this very simple structure, this stuff showing a label up top, evaluate the Boolean, test it whether it's false or not. If it's false, which is represented by zero, you go out of the loop. Otherwise, you go into the body of the loop, jump back top, reevaluate the expression that controls you, and on and on. So to implement it, we need to generate labels, and particularly unique labels. So we have a little routine that essentially generates a new label, really a label with a different suffix number. And at the point where you really want to put it in a program, you define it. So we have gen label says, create me a brand new label number, define it, puts it in one spot. We'll only call define label once for each label definition. It would be illegal in Jasmine to have two different definition points for the same label. We also have a little routine called branch Z. That stands for branch zero. And again, you could put zero in if that's more comfortable. And remember, branch zero is the same as branch false. So it says if something is false, what? It's always the thing on top of the stack. So if the thing on top of the stack is false, branch to that label. So that's how we implement, essentially, this conditional branch out of the loop. And we also have a branch, which generates an unconditional transfer of control. In JVM, it's called a go-to. Some people learn the word go-to. I learned the word branch, transfer, whatever. But essentially, unconditionally, resume execution at the target. And go-to can be used when you want to force your way out of a program or out of a loop. Now, the interesting thing is, given those little routines, here's the entire translation for something as complex as a while loop. At top, we essentially just create two string variables called top and bottom and give them new unique numbers. Then we say, is there a label on this particular structure? There may or not be. If there is, that means there's potential for a break or continue. So I go ahead and into the symbol table entry or the entry for the label, I store the top label and bottom label as the labels I've just generated. If there's not a label, I can't do a break or continue, so I don't need to store those. I then define the top label. That gives me the branch to the top of the loop. Visit the condition. That will cause a Boolean value, a 0 or a 1, to be computed on top of the stack. I then go ahead and say, if the guy on top of the stack is 0, that is false, branch to the label associated with bottom. Notice I haven't defined it yet. It's a forward go-to, but before I'm done with this loop, I will define it. I then say, let's visit the loop body and translate it. I then generate a branch, a go-to, to the top label, and then at the very bottom, after the loop is completed, I generate the bottom label. Think about it. It's pretty straightforward. And one of the remarkable things is this works trivially for nested loops. Why is that? Well, suppose I had a while inside of a while. The while would be inside the body, so I do a visit to the loop body. And I might then have this visit suspended while I'm going ahead and visiting the inner loop. But that's okay. Remember, these are methods that have their own local parameters. So the visit for the outer loop is suspended while I'm translating the inner body, which contains another loop, but it will generate different label numbers, and it'll generate the same structure, but different labels, and therefore there'll be no confusion as to whether you're executing the top, the outer label, or the inner label, or the inner while, or the outer while. So this thing does work trivially for nested loops. You may want to play with it a little bit, but it's one of these elegant things that it's done right, and nesting is not a problem. Even more interesting is how totally trivial break and continue turn out to be. Essentially one instruction. It says break me out of the loop. That's the same thing as saying going to the label at the bottom of the loop. So I go into that label and look up the bottom label stored for it and do a transfer control to it. That forces me to the instructions immediately following the loop body. If I do continue, that says go back to the top of the loop and try another iteration. And in that case, I generate a branch to the top loop. And that's it. It's hard to imagine a simpler translation for something which, when you learn it, seems kind of complex. But it is really that simple. Let's do conditionals. That's if then and if then else's. What I'll do is show you the if then else, but it's going to turn out again one of these nice little things that this will work perfectly fine for an if then. But it's sort of a spoiler warning. It'll turn out there'll be a slight inefficiency, which is mucho, mucho, mucho easy to fix. So it's going to be one of these things that when we get down to there's going to be some easy way to make extra credit. Not a ton of extra credit, but it's one of these things that's so simple. It's like the proverbial stealing candy from a baby, I guess, or something of that sort. So be alert for that. So let's look at the general structure. This is an if statement. Remember, it means evaluate conditional. If it's true, you execute the then part. There's always a then part. If it's false, you branch to an else part, which may or may not be there. For present, we'll assume it is there, but we'll see if it's not there, nothing too terrible happens. Again, we'll have a slight inefficiency, but it's an easy enough thing to fix, as you're going to show me in just a moment or two. So in this particular case, that's what the code does. It says, evaluate the conditional. If equal means if equal to zero, which is the same thing as false. So if false, go to L1. L1 is the beginning spot for where the else code is. If it's not false, you fall through and execute the then part. But notice after I have the then part, I have to make sure I don't execute also the else part. That's not what an if-then does. So when I've executed the then code, I do a go to L2, which takes me beyond the entire if-then-else and goes on to succeeding code. If I did take the branch to L1, I execute the else code, and then I just fall through the bottom to the continuing statements. So that's my notion of what I want to do. Let's see how hard it is to do. Oh, look at that. I have a visit, and that's all I need to do. I generate, again, two labels, one for the else and one for the end. I then go ahead and evaluate the Boolean condition, put it on the stack. In this case, I generate a new label for the else. I branch the zero to the else. So it says if this thing is false, that is if equal to zero, I'm going to generate a branch to the else part. Otherwise, I'm going to, in this case, translate the then part by visiting its subtree and generating code for it. I then generate the end label and branch to that after I've done the then part. I generate the else code by doing a visit to else, and then, in this case, define the label for the end. So effectively, the code generates this structure up here. So it works fine for an if, then, else. It's not so clear yet, but it turns out to be very nice. What would happen if I happen to have no code at all for the else part? Well, let's look at the code here that we want to generate and see what would happen. In that particular case, the spot where it says code for else part is nothing. So imagine it erased. And what I've done is I've gone ahead and generated a go to L2, generated L1 and L2 to represent the same point. That is legal, by the way. So I've generated a go to L2 to the very next instruction. Is that illegal? The answer is no. Is it necessary? And the answer in this case, no. So here's the case where you get a slight bit of optimization. If it's the case that I'm in an if-then without an else, I don't have to generate that go to L2, do I? Because the go to L2 in this particular case jumps me around the else part. But if there is no else part, I have nothing to jump around. So it turns out here's a nice little optimization for you. Go down to the generated code, and it says, when you're getting around to generate this jump to the else part, and where is it here, a branch to the end label, which is to generate around the else part, I don't have to do it if the else part is empty. Now, how could I check if the else part is empty? Well, I've got this little thing where I was going to visit the else part. It's called n.else part. And what can I do about n.else part? I can ask if he's null. And if he's null, then in that particular case, I don't have to generate the code to generate around the else part because there is no else part. And of course, I could visit the else part, but I don't have to either because if it's null, visiting a null statement will generate no code. So I could visit it, but it really doesn't do anything. So by putting a conditional toward the bottom there and saying, is there an else part or not, you can do a minor optimization, but it is an optimization, and that's extra credit. And here's something where some of you are jotting it down. You may already have it already done. It's that straightforward. So here's one that's real easy. Industrial strength compilers would, of course, always do that test as part of the normal translation. But in our situation, you don't have to do it. We generate valid code that's slightly less efficient if we just do the form I've shown here. And if you don't want to do the optimization, don't do it. It's one of those cases where I want correct code, and once we got correct code, then we're worried about optimizing it. So that's a nice little optimization. And again, the nice thing about this is if you look at it and understand what the parts are doing, it's pretty easy to see that it does work. So we've got a couple of other things to do, and we've got time to do it. And it's one of these oddities that we're going to see that in the JVM, generating code for what looks like it ought to be a simple operation gets a tad more complex than you might have guessed. And the reason is that the JVM designers were actually smarter than we were, or at least I was, when I designed the code. The problem is the following. I want to generate code for not and or plus or minus, but I want to generate for the six conditionals, or the six comparisons, equal, not equal, less than or equal, greater than or equal. You would think that the JVM folks would have said, okay, we'll just put in an opcode. Push a value, compare them, and push a 0 or 1 on the stack. Turns out they don't do that. The way they do it is they do have instructions, but they look at first glance to be pretty screwball instructions. They say, here's the way I can go ahead and compare two values. Again, I'll put them on the stack. But what happens is that, well, first thing, I have this relation code that says for the six different relational operators, equal and not equal and so on, here are the codes that the JVM uses. And for most cases, they're fairly minor translations. But what happens, to do those six operations at the bottom here, you generate this very odd-looking instruction that says if underscore I comp, and then add in one of these six options, equal, not equal, less than or equal, etc. And what it does is a conditional branch. So it says, if the comparison of the top two values is equal, branch. It doesn't put a Boolean on the stack. It does a branch. Now, can anybody have any guess why they would have done that? Turns out these are not idiots. They were really very good computer scientists. So why are they giving me a conditional branch when I want a value? And the reason is I really don't want a value in most cases. Think about all the times when you've written down equal or not equal, less than, greater than. I'll bet you that 90, perhaps 95% of them, perhaps higher, was in the context of a while loop or an if statement or some signed conditional, for loop maybe. Is that true? Just think about it. You say if something's equal to something, it's a then. Or while something's not equal, it's a while loop. Or for something, while something is less than a limit. So what's happening, in those cases, you're in a conditional that wants to do a branch. So what happens is, this particular system says this is the way you do most of them, but we're saying that if you do a comparison, you have to also be able to put a Boolean on the stack. And by the way, this is going to open up yet another optimization, something called jump code. I'll probably talk about jump code two lectures from now. It's in the textbook, and you might want to look at it ahead, because this is worth extra credit. And it turns out that is using these instructions the way the JVM designers intended to do it. We're going to generate code that works, but it's going to be kind of stupid. And I'm not blaming you because I'm designed it. But it's stupid because it's simple. And remember, there's that famous principle called the KISS principle. And what does KISS stand for in this case? It's not the rock and rollers KISS, but what does it stand for? Keep it simple, students, because I'm not allowed to insult my clientele. So keep it simple, students, and that's what I'm going to try to follow. But then once we understand the simple version, we're going to do a better version. So what happens is we have to figure out how to do comparisons that generate a Boolean. Because we have a rule that says you may say A, the Boolean value B, for example, gets A not equal to B or A not equal to C as a Boolean. You hardly ever use it that way, but it is legal. It's legal in Java too, by the way, and they have to figure out a way of doing it. So we'll first implement this. We'll then go ahead and see how we use it in a while loop or an if, and then I'll give you some insights on how to optimize it. So we have to go ahead and do a conditional branch for comparisons because that's all the JVM gives us. They gave it to us because deep down they knew that's what we really needed, but sometimes we have to figure out we need it before we can appreciate it. So here's what we're going to do. And what we're essentially do is we're going to generate a mini if statement that if statement is not going to generate then code or else code, but rather is going to push a 1 representing true or a 0 representing false. So here's how I'll go ahead and generate a relational operator, like equal or not equal. I'll go ahead and generate a true label. You can guess what that is, in a skip. So true label and skip are two places where I'll go. And what I'll do is I'll go ahead and generate a branch relational compare using the top two operands and having a true label. The true label will essentially label a load of 1, which represents a 1. Otherwise, it'll load a 0, which is false, and do a skip. So let me show you the code. So I'm doing something like, let's compute I equal equal j. So we'll essentially do a code to load I onto the stack, load j onto the stack. In this particular case, I want to do equal, so I do an if underscore, if underscore icmp eq. And in that particular case, I'll do that to the true label. So I'll put the true label down here somewhere, and I'll just call it true. So it's, and so it's saying, if the top two guys on the stack compare equal, branch to the true. What's the true going to do? It's, in this particular case, it's going to do a load constant of 1. And otherwise, I'll do a go to skip. Oh, and here I have to do a load constant of 0 and skip. So this is how we'll implement a comparison. Load I, load j, do the right conditional branch, and it will either push a 1 or a 0 onto the stack. Perfectly valid code, except now let's go back and assuming that we are doing this in the context of an if. So we're doing if. And remember, this is almost certainly the context in which you do something like compare this. So we're doing an if. One of the first things the if thing does is say, put a Boolean on top of the stack. And then what does it do? Having done all this, this is all the stuff that represents I equal equal j. It says evaluate this. And what did it do once it evaluated a Boolean? It decided if it was true or false. If it's true, then it's going to fall through. If it's false, it's going to generate, jump to the else part. So remember that we had this branch 0 to the else label. Else, otherwise we have the then part. Now, does anybody notice anything particularly disgusting about this code sequence? I've pushed something, did a compare to put a Boolean. I pushed something, did a conditional branch to load a Boolean, which controlled the conditional branch. What I could have done, and this is what this jump code is about, I'm not going to give you the full flavor, but I'll show you why it's a comparison, is that if I have a relational operator in the context of an if or a while, that is where I'm really generating conditional branches anyway, what I do here, it's situation there that I've loaded I, loaded j, and it says, if I is equal to j, in this case, I want to do the then part. But if it's false, I want to go to the else part. So I change this from equal to not equal. Each relational operator has an inverse, equal versus not equal, less than versus greater than or equal, greater versus less than or equal, something that gives the exact opposite. So if I go ahead and did this thing and says, jump to, in this case, the else part, I don't need any of this gobbledygook. Load I, load j, if they're not equal, that means it's false. Go to the else part, otherwise fall through the then part. And that is the genius of jump code. So again, I haven't gone through this yet, I'm just giving you a flavor. So what we're generating is valid, and the reason we do it is we have to be able to generate relational operators that produce a Boolean for assignment. But in most cases, we produce a Boolean to control a loop or control an if-then. And in those cases, we use a conditional branch to set up a conditional branch. But you don't have to. You can go ahead and use jump code. And we'll talk about that in future. But if you want extra credit, and this is worth way more than what I talked about a few moments ago, jump code is really a very cool sort of alternative. The reason for it is we're used to storing values in places, like in memory. But another way to store information in a computer program is kind of what they did in The Wizard of Oz. And back when I was first seeing The Wizard of Oz, it was still being broadcast in black and white. But if you've seen Wizard of Oz recently, and I guess every person should have, one of the great scenes is when Dorothy comes out of her cabin, opens the door, and what happens when she opens the door? It had been in black and white, and all of a sudden it's in color. And you see this grand color. Remember, back then, color movies were very rare, so it's black and white. And she does the famous line, the line that, you know, that everybody remembers. What does she say when she opens the door and looks outside? Says, Toto, I don't think we're in Kansas anymore. But notice what they were doing is they were using color to indicate information. If it's in color, you're in Oz. If it's in black and white at the beginning and the end of the movie, you're back in, what was her, she's in Kansas. Did they say what place in Kansas? Nowheresville, Kansas, or wherever, or something. Maybe he's from Kansas, I apologize, but that. So what we're doing, the same thing. We're storing information not by whether you're in black and white and color, but whether you're in one area of code or another. So jump code actually says you can produce information like a Boolean, true or false, not by having a zero or one sitting anywhere, but whether you jump to this piece of code or jump to that piece of code. And when we talk about jump code in general, it's really kind of a cool thing to see how far you can handle it. So at any rate, that's a little bit of insight there. So let's go back to... So in this case, we generate the relational operator, and essentially that uses conditional branches to put a 0 or 1 on the stack, and that's the definition of what we wanted. When we go back to Boolean operator, to binary operators, we include a clause to contain, to handle relational operators, just as shown. And that being the case, we only have a little bit of code to do, and we'll be out of here. And that is doing implementation of cast nodes. Now, the cool thing from code generation's point of view of cast nodes is normally you don't have to generate any code at all. That means if you cast, for example, a Boolean into an integer, whatever the 0 or 1 you had as a Boolean becomes a 0 or 1 considered to be an integer. If I cast a character into an integer, whatever character code the character had stops being a character code and becomes an integer. But no code needs to be generated. It's just a matter of having type checking change the apparent type. There are a couple of places where you do need to do some code generation. One of them is when you're trying to cast an integer into a Boolean. A zero changes into a zero, but if I add 1, 2, 3 as an integer, I translate that into one. The notion being zero is false, everything else is true. And that's oftentimes the way Booleans are handled. So what we do is we go ahead and if it's the case where trying to cast an integer or a character into a Boolean, we essentially load the zero and do this relational operator business by comparing the value against zero and seeing if it's equal to zero or not. If it's equal to zero, then it's false. Otherwise, it's true. So that's what this part up here is doing. And down here, we're saying, well, what does it mean if we have an integer and I want to translate it into a character? There's a lot of definitions you might give. The one we give, and the most common one, is the integer may have way more bits than a character ever can do. So what we'll do is we'll take the rightmost 7 bits, which are just enough for an ASCII character, and keep those and throw away all the rest. And how do I do that? Well, I do that by generating a special kind of AND instruction. This is a bitwise AND, but notice, by the way, you could probably use this for AND and the ORs to implement the Boolean AND and ORs. But essentially what happens is, if I have an integer that has some number of bits, so 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1, for example. And again, remember, all integers are really just bits in binary form. And it says characters in ASCII are 7 bits long. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. They're there. And what I do is I load onto a stack something that's all zeros except for the final 7 bits, which are all ones. And then I execute an AND instruction. This is a bitwise and. And an and instruction. Let's see. Yeah. So. Wait a minute. That's it. Oh, yeah, yeah, I'm sorry, I was thinking ahead, so too long a lecture. So in this particular case, if I and together one and one, what's the result? So remember, and says both of them have to be one. So this is a one. And I get a one here and a one here. If I do an and of zero with a one, what do I get? Zeros. So effectively what this does is extract the rightmost 7 bits verbatim. So 1 1 1 0 1 0 0, but all the remaining bits are zero, and zero and anything is zero. So effectively, it zeros out all the remaining bits, and ends up giving me a 7-bit quantity where previously I had a bigger quantity. And this is a perfectly fine character because it's 7 bits long and it's a valid ASCII character. So that's what we're doing there. So essentially, we're throwing away the bits beyond the last 7 and keeping the rest. And that's what the code generation does, and that's what the bottom cast does, and I believe that's it. So, hey. And we beat the system by 3 minutes, so we're ahead of the game. Any questions on any of that? So what I'll be doing next time is talking about segments 3 and 4 of the code generation notes. You can print those out in advance if you like, or I'll bring copies prior to the lecture come next week.